I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson. In a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick, Galen, Arlen, Bo, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan, David, The West Bank Robbery Podcast, Gary, Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho, Brian, Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallaxes listeners. On this edition of the program, another in our continuing series on the events unfolding in the Middle East. This time we're joined by Rethinking Foreign Policy's Mitchell Plitnick. Let's get right to the conversation. Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that I always enjoy having on, Mitchell Plitnick of Rethinking Foreign Policy, a really great 501c3 nonprofit that tries to get us to take a sort of clearer thinking approach to U.S. foreign policy and promoting progressive change on that front. How are you doing?
It's a difficult week.
I'm at a loss for words, really, but what are your initial thoughts on what is happening now with the bombing of Gaza and then also what preceded that, the Hamas attack?
Yeah, I mean, the first and foremost for me, you know, as for many people I know who are working on this issue, you know, our first concern is the relatives and friends and colleagues that we have in both Israel and Palestine, especially in Gaza right now. So, I mean, it's hard to, you know, as an analyst, my job is kind of to you know, sort of step back and you know, evaluate these things rationally and with some degree, you know, I bring ethics to it, but you know, with some degree of detachment, of professional detachment, I can't, you know, it's very hard to do that right now. That being said, you know, what's happening now in Gaza is something that even for Israeli attacks on Gaza is unprecedented. There are no words for it. Israel has intentionally and shamelessly stated quite openly that they are, you know, they are not going to bother with worrying about who they're targeting. They're just trying to devastate Gaza. They don't care about how many civilians that they kill. They have made sure that people can, you know, it was sort of ironic. Netanyahu, before this, just before it started, told people in Gaza to leave, which was, you know, my reaction was, you know, he must think that's a very funny joke in his twisted mind. But even if Gazans wanted to leave, not only is Israel, you know, blockaded the northern, eastern, and western borders and the coastline, so that Gazans can't leave that way. The only way Gazans could leave is through the south, the Rafah crossing into Egypt, which Israel today bombed to make sure that they could not leave that way either. So this is, we're talking here about a slaughter of civilians of unprecedented proportions. They're already nearing 1,000 casualties, 1,000 people killed. And Israel has been very clear. They ain't even started yet. They have this is nothing. So we're talking about something really, really, really horrific. And you know, the thing that I think has been important to me to say to people for the last 4 days has been one war crime does not justify another. So that goes to a lot of things. That what Hamas did over the weekend was without a doubt. There is no way around it. It was a war crime and a major one.
Yeah, I think the images people have seen from the Supernova Music Festival will. I mean, I was mortified by it. So
it was horrible. And those images, you know, are only part of the picture. The according to Israel, they have 1,500 members of Hamas dead in Israel right now, on Israeli territory right now. So that gives you some idea of the size and scope of this infiltration. But you know, besides the music festival, I mean, these people were going from house to house, just breaking into people's homes and killing them, injuring them, kidnapping them. It was really an atrocity, and there's no two ways about that. And that can't be justified by Israel's ongoing apartheid against the Palestinians. That being said, also, it can't be justified, but we can look at this and recognize that over many years, many decades, you know, the apartheid system that Israel has imposed has strangled Palestinians, and now they have cut off all peaceful means for Palestinians to try and address this. They have made negotiations completely futile. They have the United States has worked with Israel to block pretty much every avenue of international law that Palestinians could turn to. What they haven't been able to completely block, they've slowed to a crawl, as we've seen with the International Criminal Court that it took 5 years just to accept a case from Palestine and hasn't moved since. For fear, that is, of the United States. That is why that is going so slow. So there, you know, the Israelis act with impunity when nonviolent protests by Palestinians go on. And then to top it all off, the one piece of leverage that the Palestinians have had over the years has been Arab countries and Israel's desire to normalize relations, and starting with Donald Trump, but very much enthusiastically taken up by Joe Biden. The United States has worked night and day tirelessly to strip Palestinians of even that last option. So, you know, when you take away all of the peaceful means and you're dealing with the people who are as badly outgunned in any military sense as the Palestinians are, this is what happens. I mean, historically, this is what happens when people have no other recourse to fight occupation or tyranny, this kind of violence. And yes, it goes against civilians and it is illegal and it is atrocious. And that's not a justification of it. But it is what happens when you pursue the kinds of policies that the United States and Israel have pursued.
So you said they've taken away all these options. Were you talking there about the, I was wondering what your take is on the efforts at, you know, like Saudi-Israel normalization and normalization between all these Gulf countries.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about when I say that Donald Trump started this process and Joe Biden has enthusiastically taken it up. It is this normalization, the Abraham Accords and this normalization process that completely bypasses the Palestinians. So
was going to say is, like, my understanding is that these normalization processes are basically these Arab states are in a way throwing Palestinians under the bus for a better relationship with Israel. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, what, you know, they are getting, I mean, they're actually, their goal, like the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, all of those countries, as well as Morocco, all of those countries, their real goal was not a better relationship with Israel. Their real goal was a better relationship with the United States and the ability to buy better weapons and get more security guarantees from the United States. That's really the prize. Especially for Saudi Arabia, that has been what the Saudis are after. They wanted several things from the U.S. They still want them, although right now I think that process is going to be on hold for a while. But the Saudis probably will look for an opportunity to resume them at some point down the road, because they want to be able to get better weapons from the United States, and they need certain recognitions from the U.S. in order to qualify to get upgraded, higher level weapons. They want the United States to get into some sort of security pact with them, which they want very much because they were very disappointed in 2019 when they were attacked by Houthis. Their oil fields were attacked. Some people may remember the Houthis attacked Saudi oil fields, and Saudi Arabia expected the Trump administration to respond by bombing Iran, and the Trump administration did not take any military action. And the Saudis were very disappointed by that, because Trump had talked very tough about doing things like that. And then when push came to shove, he just backed away, which was good. I mean, it was good that he backed away as far as the world is concerned, but the Saudis were unhappy about it. And so they want a security pact with the United States. So all of these things that they want, these Arab dictatorships never truly cared about the Palestinians, but it is still, a bit of leverage that the Palestinians had. 20 years ago, the Saudis tried to resolve this issue with the Arab Peace Initiative, which offered the full normalization with Israel of all members of the League of Arab States in exchange for Israel ending the occupation, sharing Jerusalem as the capital of two states, and coming to some accommodation based on international law for the Palestinian refugees. Those were the conditions. And that technically that offer is still on the table, but clearly the Saudis have now superseded it by going much lower. I mean, what they were talking about was something like, throw the Palestinians a bone, basically something that keeps the concept of a two-state solution alive. I mean, it would have been nothing. So was that part of Hamas's calculus in launching this attack? I think it was, although I don't think it was the primary motivation. But again, this is what happens. Hamas has been trying to, for years, they had reached a certain uneasy detente with Israel, with violent flare-ups from time to time. But, there was a sort of maintaining of a level of not peaceful relations by any means, but they lived with the siege on Gaza. Israel only bombed them once every couple of years, and they would stop after a while. So it didn't escalate to the point that it's escalating to now. And Hamas realized that was getting them nowhere. That sort of cooperation was not getting them anywhere. It was not helping them on the international stage. And Palestinians were getting more and more, the whole issue of Palestine was getting more and more swept under the rug in the diplomatic world. So, I certainly think that was part, that bigger picture issue was a big motivating factor for this.
One thing I wanted to talk about with you, I've just been noticing a lot of people, especially I would say people that have an explicitly anti-Palestinian view, are saying, why do you care about the bombing so much? They should have thought about this. The Palestinians are getting what they deserve because Hamas did this. This is all on Hamas. And I mean, the thing that upsets me is I don't blame every Jewish person for the actions of Israel, but it seems like Palestinians are being blamed for everything Hamas has done.
Yeah, and I think that is true. And on top of that, I mean, there are clear principles here of international law that we're talking about. So the clearest one is the prohibition of collective punishment, right? And that is by definition what Israel is engaging in right now. It is bombing the entire Gaza Strip. It is bombing hospitals. It is bombing universities. Apartment buildings, every market, one of the main marketplaces in I believe it was in Jabalia refugee camp. They're clearly targeting, civilian sites. It has nothing. There's no relationship with any Hamas targets or any of that sort of thing. That is a blatant war crime. There's, again, no two ways about that. So, are the Palestinians being Palestinians are blamed for everything, even aside from whether you're talking about the PLO or Hamas or whoever, we hear all the time, if the Palestinians would just stop, recognize Israel as a Jewish state, which is an unreasonable ask. That's a different discussion. But if the Palestinians would just stop attacking Israelis, all of these things, and actually all of these things have been tried. You know, the PLO has several times recognized Israel as a sovereign state and recognized its right to exist. There have been times when there have been extended periods, actually, where there's been no sort of a single Palestinian here or there may get fed up and take some sort of violent action. But there have been extended periods where nothing organized has happened. Israel doesn't change its policies when that goes on. In fact, it takes it as an invitation to expand settlements and to tighten the occupation on the West Bank and to tighten the siege on Gaza. So, the bottom line is that Palestinian people are seen as less than human. We just saw literally a few minutes before we started this conversation, I just saw a part of Joe Biden's statement about this, and it was all about Hamas's attack on Israel. It was all about the tragic loss of life of Israelis, and I feel that I'm very strong. One of my responses to this that I put out on social media was just to tell anyone who is devaluing the life of anybody in this conflict, whether they are Israeli or Palestinian, you just go away. I don't want to hear from you. And I don't care which side you're on. If you're devaluing the life of the people on the other side, you are the problem. But that's exactly what Biden.
I just want to say, I'm very tired of people acting like this is a football game. It's not a football mm-hmm. game. There's real lives on the line.
There's real lives at stake. But and again, therein lies the problem, because the president of the United States just completely devalued Palestinian lives. The only lives he cared about, and the only lives he does care about. And he has made this clear. He, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd, they have all made this abundantly clear from day one of their administration. Palestinian lives are worthless to them. Palestinians are not even human in their eyes. They simply don't care.
I know I'm going to have listeners that will say, oh, that's a strong statement. Do you have evidence for that? I guess.
Take a look at the policies. Look at the policies and look at the complete lack of effort. The Israeli army shot and killed an American citizen, but she was also Palestinian.
Shireen
Abu Akleh. And not only, right away, the United States immediately accepted Israel's explanation when it came out through American media as well as international media that Israel was blatantly lying. The United States insisted on Israel's explanation until members of the Senate had to say, come on, what are you doing? And demanded real answers. And even then, I just wanted to finish this. Even then, there was no push from the White House or the State Department to get to the bottom of it at all, to hold anyone accountable. That is the value, because even for an American citizen, the life of a Palestinian is so worthless to these people that even if that Palestinian is an American citizen, they still don't care.
I was going to say also, I remember, I've been annoyed by people that will say, oh, if you're upset with what Hamas did, why don't you recognize what has happened to the Palestinians? And I can be very upset with what Hamas has done, especially the civilian casualties. But I, for a fact, people can go through my archives, I've covered Shireen Abu Akleh, and I've covered Huwara. I've covered the police killing of an autistic man by Israeli police. And what annoys me, though, is I understand and I acknowledge and I condemn Hamas's killing of civilians, but I don't remember very much media coverage at all of the Huwara rampage. Just mm-hmm. it was like radio silence. And to me, there is Palestinians have a point when they say there's double standard.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You can look at it in many different ways. But I think when we see When I say that this administration has shown absolute indifference to the lives of Palestinians, again, look at the proof is in the policy. I mean, in the end, it doesn't really matter what Joe Biden personally thinks or Antony Blinken personally thinks. What matters is their policies and what they decide to do. And what they have done is historic. They are the first. Biden will be the first. It looks like, I mean, unless something dramatically changes, he will be the first president to not even try to broker any kind of negotiations, to do any. Even Trump came up with it was a terrible plan, but even Trump came up with what he called a peace plan. Biden hasn't even done that. Biden's policy here has been an utter atrocity on every single level. They have barely paid lip service to the Palestinians. The one thing that they have done is they have restored some funding to the UN Refugee Works Agency, UNRWA, so that some Palestinian refugees at least will not starve to death. That's the one thing that they've really done, and they've done very little else. But yet on the other hand, here we have an Israeli government that Americans do not like. Certainly Democrats do not like, see it as correctly as proto-fascist, at least, if not entirely fascist, see it as increasingly authoritarian, see it as provocative. And we have done nothing but, well, we've done nothing but shower that far right government with gifts. He didn't give Netanyahu a meeting in the White House, but who cares? Again, matters of policy have been absolutely 100%. Israel gets everything it wants. So, you know, when I say that Biden's policy is really about as bad as it gets, it is. He has been an utter atrocity on this issue.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was going to say, with regards to Netanyahu and the far right, I mean, it cannot be understated. He has been cozying up to the far right in Europe, nationalist Absolutely. Leaders. And also, I mean, his coalition government involves parties like the Religious Zionist Party and the Jewish Power Party, Otzma Yehudit, I believe it's called. These are extreme parties. Could you speak to the far right in Israel and its influence?
So this, I mean, one thing that I think is important is to somebody else pointed this out that I was listening to this morning, but is not to overstate how much of what's happening now is due to this far right. This government is extreme. There's no question about it. Not just the presence of people like Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir in this government. These are people who have openly called for genocide. Ben-Gvir is a convicted terrorist, Jewish terrorist. The presence of these parties has turned up the volume on things that Israel was already doing. So we already had, before these guys were in office, we already had the Israeli military protecting settlers in the West Bank as they rampage through Palestinian towns. They're just doing it more openly, more blatantly, and more often now. But that was happening before. That's been happening for many years. Settlement expansion, obviously, that's been happening, you know, all along since the occupation started in 1967. The uptick in raids on Palestinian towns, those have gotten more violent. They've used drones for the first time. But raids on Palestinian towns were a regular event even before these guys were there. All of these things, what they've really done is simply made it all worse and more visible. They've stripped, in a sense, they've stripped away Israel's plausible deniability and have exposed the occupation for the violent apartheid regime that it is. And that's why more people are recognizing it. And now they are seeing an opportunity to actually pursue genocide, literal ethnic cleansing and genocide on a large scale, particularly in Gaza. But, you know, there's things happening in the West Bank, too. I saw a report this morning from Hanan Ashrawi of the PLO. She said that 18 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since all of this started. You know, no one's paying any attention to the West Bank at the moment because there's so much with Gaza, and you know, understandably so. But you know, that is another hotspot as well. So this right wing government is pushing things to a higher level. And certainly they've been very provocative. I think one of the proximate causes of Hamas's attack is probably the settlers who went to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the Jewish holiday of Sukkot to celebrate the holiday there, which was a very clear sort of provocation of the Palestinians. They do this on purpose and they do it regularly. I think that one was that might have been something that kind of pushed the needle for Hamas. But yeah, we're seeing more and more of this because this government is so far right.
So, you know, I think people have heard this term, settlers, they've heard settlement expansion, but even to this day, when I talk to, you know, the average Joe six pack, they may be needing an explanation of what we mean by the settlers and settlement expansion in the West Bank. Can you give maybe a brief primer on that?
Well, you know, since Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, as well as, you know, the Sinai Peninsula, they started to end the Golan Heights. They set up settlements in those places. Basically, so Israel would set up settlements in these places as a way of sort of de facto annexing them. Even though the government kept saying, no, that's not, they're just temporary. I mean, if they were temporary, why are you allowing them to be set up in the first place? And they said, you know, well, you know, we don't want to start getting into a fight and we're occupying. And you know, so it went on and obviously, you know, went on for many, many decades. It's still going on. So you're talking about 50, what is it now? 20, 30, 56 years. So that is a way of not only sort of de facto annexing parts of what's now the West Bank, is where that expansion is limited to, but it also squeezes Palestinian towns and villages, right? So as those settlements expand, there's zones around them that are security zones that Palestinians can't go to. Many of them end up subsuming Palestinian privately owned land. So Palestinians lose their land and those people simply have to move in with relatives somewhere else that settlers haven't taken over yet.
So the settlers are literally taking these homes.
Yeah. And you have, well, in some places, in many places, the army, what often happens is the army will declare an area a closed military zone and force people to leave. Other places, the army will say, you know, we'll demolish homes on the pretext that they built an addition on it that was not licensed. Of course, Palestinians can never get a license to build in outside of major Palestinian run villages and cities, like, you know, in the big cities, they can build what they want. But those cities also, they're hemmed in by their borders, which they can't expand outward because of the growth of the settlements and the roads that connect the settlements to each other and to regular, you know, regular Israel, which Palestinians are not allowed to use. So those sort of carve up the West Bank and strangle Palestinian towns and villages. The settlers themselves, and there's a wide variety of people who live in those settlements, but when we talk about the settlement movement and we talk about sort of the far-right settlers, these are people who are ultra-nationalists, mostly religious fanatics. Interestingly, religious fanatics who conveniently disregard the tenets of Jewish law whenever it suits them to, you know, for example, on the Sabbath, going in jeeps to harass or assault Palestinians. This happens all the time, even though you're not allowed to drive on the Sabbath. You're not allowed to carry things outside of enclosed areas on the Sabbath. You know, they toss that aside at convenience, and yet they claim to be highly, you know, highly religious. So, you know, there's a great deal of hypocrisy there as well. But these people are, you know, they are ultra-nationalists and essentially believe that Palestinians shouldn't be there at all.
Well, some of these people don't even refer to them as Palestinians. These are like Kahanists that will say there are no Palestinians. They're Arabs. You know, I mean, they don't even recognize these people.
And of course, Palestinians are Arabs, but that's not confined only to the settlement movement. There are many in the pro-Israel community who believe that the entire Palestinian, the concept of a Palestinian nationality is made up. Simply to thwart the Zionist goals, that is why there is even such a thing as a Palestinian. They talk about how there was no such thing as a Palestinian before this time or that time, which is not true. Palestinian culture dates back a long, long time. But nationalism in general is a modern phenomenon. I mean, there was the Jewish nationalism, which is Zionism, that didn't come into being until the late 19th century either, which was a little bit actually after the modern concept of Palestinian nationalism evolved out of a long history of Palestinian communities in that area. But, again, that's a whole other discussion. But yes, I mean, that thinking, my point just being, that thinking is not confined to the far right. The right and even some of the center, even some of the center left, you find that belief on a little bit in terms of the pro-Israel community around the world and in Israel.
What do you think the biggest misconceptions people have when we're talking about Gaza, Israel, even if we're talking about Hamas? What are the biggest misconceptions people have about this whole issue more broadly?
The misconceptions are huge, right? I mean, and the propaganda is a massive industry that supports the Israeli narrative and Israeli point of view. But I think the biggest, the most damaging misconception is the idea that Palestinians are only opposed to Israel and the Israelis because it is a Jewish movement and a Jewish state. That, I think, is the most damaging. The idea that this is motivated by anti-Semitism. Now, of course, there's anti-Semitism, there's racism, there's sexism everywhere. There's no community in the world that isn't touched by these things, of course. But that is not what this is about. Palestinians are not allowed to live their lives. That is the bottom line. They have children who they are looking at growing up in a hopeless world, especially for people in Gaza, but it's true for Palestinians in the West Bank. It's true for Palestinians in refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon. Used to be also in Syria, but most of those have been destroyed in the recent wars. That is what motivates this conflict: Palestinian dispossession and the Israeli refusal to negotiate on that, to recognize that Palestinians deserve the same rights that they have. That is fundamentally what this conflict is about. And it would not matter if the people who were doing this to the Palestinians were other Arabs. It wouldn't make a difference. It wouldn't matter if they were Saudi, if they were Iraqi, if they were Moroccan. It would not make a difference. It would not matter if these were Christians. It wouldn't matter if they were Buddhists. The fact that they're Jews helps to add to the narrative that Israel is somehow the besieged party here, when it is in fact a regional power, a military hegemon, and the most stable economy in the region, most diverse economy. There's a lot that Israel has going for it, and it yet still refuses to acknowledge Palestinian rights. That's what this is about. It is not about the fact that Israel is a Jewish state. It's about the fact that Israel is a Jewish state that privileges only Jews.
I don't know if you want to talk about this very much, but one thing I don't see being covered that much, among some of the casualties from the Hamas attack, we have people like, I don't want to mispronounce his name, but I believe it's Chaim Katzman, who is an anti-apartheid activist. And I think there's a concern now that the memory of these people who did fight for the rights of Palestinians is going to be forgotten or even used to support bombing of civilians in Gaza. Yep. Could you talk to the kind of activists in Israel that have pushed back on their own government?
So I've seen, and I'm very thankful that nobody I personally know has been, that I know of, has been killed or kidnapped or injured in these attacks. I'm so far, I have yet to hear of anyone that I know personally, but I do know people personally who have lost friends, comrades, colleagues. When you unleash violence on a large scale, you don't ask the political beliefs of the targets, right? So there are folks, anytime there's an attack on Israelis, the same as anytime there's an attack on Palestinians, folks get killed, injured, hit. who are trying to be part of the solution. That happens all the time. It's happening right now to people in Gaza, and it happened this weekend. Katzman was one person. There was her name is now slipping my mind, but a longtime Israeli feminist activist. I know her, she's a friend of many of my friends. Unfortunately, I'm sorry. Her name is slipping my mind right now, who was kidnapped and brought apparently into Gaza. And she has been somebody who has stood together with Palestinian women and has been a leader in the anti-apartheid movement in Israel.
Was this Vivian Silver or?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Silver, I think, is it Vivian Silver? Yeah, I think that's her name. Yes, that sounds right. That, again, people don't, you know, no one's asking your political credentials before they do whatever they're going to do. So this is what happens. And, you know, of course, people, and I get this too, they point to these folks, right-wingers will point to these folks and say, look, you see what it gets you? This is what Hamas would do to you if they got, which is, you know, incidentally not true. I've been to Gaza, I've been to the West Bank. It's not, you know, I've spoken with people who at least said they were sympathetic to Hamas. Everyone's always been, you know, perfectly fine with me. So
there's also Israeli Palestinians or Israeli Arabs that were killed in these attacks by Hamas.
I mean, yeah, which always happens. Especially that's going to be especially true in the areas near Gaza, because those areas tend to be working class towns. So they tend to have more Arabs. To the extent that they're mixed towns, they will have more Arabs in them, as well as Arabs working in them. And the Jews who many of the Jews who live in those towns, like Sderot and other towns near Gaza, are often of Middle Eastern descent themselves. So and these are, you know, again, poorer towns, working class towns, that, and which also explains, by the way, one of the reasons that they're constantly being victimized, because they're not a high priority for the Israeli government. One of the things that seems, at least initially, to have led up to this is the fact that many of Israel's security forces were transferred from that area to the West Bank to protect settlers. And apparently Hamas took advantage of that fact when they came through the separation wall. That is stuff. Those are things that Israelis are going to be sorting out, I think, for quite a while after all of this is over, and will not look good for this government. But that the fact of the matter is that when these attacks happen, and look, if somebody is a right winger and you know, holds those beliefs and even supports, you know, military action against Gaza, that does not give anyone else the right to kill them. So I don't want to make too strong a distinction there. The civilians are civilians, and their political beliefs in the end don't matter. They all have the right to be free from free. You know, they could be a voter for Otzma Yehudit, the Jewish Power Party. If that's who they voted for, that's who they voted for. Same as in Gaza, if you are an administrator in the Gaza government, that means you work for Hamas. Doesn't mean that Israel has a right to kill you. Even if you are a member of Hamas, but you are not a combatant at that moment, that means you can't, you know, you are a civilian. These principles should continue to hold, and we need to recognize them. This is, you know, when we hold these principles and apply them equally to both sides, that's the way out of all of this.
I was wondering if you could speak to, maybe this is outside the realm of your expertise, I don't know, because I know you cover U.S. foreign policy more than necessarily the Netanyahu government, but I see a lot of people saying, this is going to create a rally around the flag effect for Netanyahu. At the same time, though, I'm seeing the reports from Haaretz and Times of Israel, and I know they have their own sort of biases in their own audience that may be a little bit more liberal or left-leaning within Israel. But they've made a really, I think, important insight, which is, you know, this is the biggest intelligence and operational failure imaginable for Netanyahu. Do you think this will hurt Netanyahu in any way? And can you talk about the failure to prevent this?
Well, I think we're going to I think the internal Israeli political ramifications are yet to be seen. And I think a lot will have to do with what happens over the next few weeks. I think there will be, you know, Israel is clearly planning a ground offensive, which I cannot believe for, at all that Hamas is not prepared for, prepared in a way they have not, you know, judging by their recent effectiveness, I would say they're probably more prepared than they have been in the past. And they've been, you know, they've been able to stand up to Israel the last couple of times Israel has tried to come in on the ground. That's why in the most recent attacks, Israel has not done that. So we will see how that all shakes out within Israel. But there's no question, this was a massive intelligence failure. I think, and I think there's a couple of points about that. One is Netanyahu, apparently, according to the Egyptians, was warned that something was going to happen. The head of Egyptian intelligence said that he warned Netanyahu that something big was going to happen out of Gaza. He didn't know what, but he knew something was brewing. And apparently Netanyahu shrugged his shoulders, basically didn't care. Now, of course, the prime minister's office has issued a statement saying that is a complete lie and this and that. But I mean, it's a little hard to see why Egypt would lie about that. It doesn't make them look good because essentially they're betraying the Palestinian in Gaza. They're betraying Hamas. That I don't think that's going to play well in the Egyptian public. So I don't see why they would make that up. And plus, you know, the idea that Netanyahu says it's a lie is kind of laughable considering how dishonest this guy is. I mean, you know, I think most people, even right wingers in Israel, would agree with that, that you know, you don't trust this guy as far as you can throw him. So there is that part of it. I think also, though, you know, look, in the end, we see this. We asked the same question in 2001 after 9/11. How did we not know? How did the Bush administration not know? Well, you know, sometimes when you go up, when the militants or the terrorists, whatever kind of word you want to use for them, go off the grid, and they know what your capabilities are, and they avoid those, you know, they don't use the cell phone to communicate with each other. They don't use electronic means to communicate with each other. They send messages through, you know, people on foot or in cars, whatever. They send them on pieces of paper that can be destroyed. Who knows exactly how they did it? There's ways to do this. And you know, the idea that Hamas is, or any group, is completely incapable of thwarting intelligence, I think is a little bit arrogant. We've seen these kinds of failures before. This is how it's done. So but that being said, there's a lot of people in Israel that are asking those questions. And as I said earlier, you know, people are also asking about the transfer of soldiers to the West Bank, and thinning out those security forces. These are questions that Netanyahu is going to face. Now, right now, he's trying to put together a unity government, which is frequently what Israel does in times of large scale conflict. But they will, you know, they've declared war, so Netanyahu sensibly wants to set up sort of a unity government. It is unclear at this moment whether that will be successful, although I think chances are it will. Because I think too much of the opposition is going to say, we do not want these guys, you know, people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir being the people. These are people who don't have military experience. They don't have, you know, the guy they want talking about this stuff is Benny Gantz, who's maybe the leading leader of the opposition. They want him involved because he knows what he's doing. So
I was going to say, I think Lapid said, you know, ditch the far right and we'll do an emergency mm-hmm. government.
The problem for Netanyahu is if he does that, the far right's not going to come back when this is over. And that's going to leave him out to dry with his legal troubles as well as his political problems. So that's where I think it gets tricky for him, because in the end, Netanyahu, you know, it can be literally a million Israelis' lives can be lost before he's going to care about what's, you know, about or do something where he is not first looking after his own personal interest. I think that's the kind of leader, unfortunately, that Israelis have now. And so there's real complications there for him as to where, you know, where this is going to go. So I think what he's trying to do is find a way to bring in the opposition without kicking out the far right. And that may work, because the opposition is motivated to try and figure out a way to put together a unity government here.
So you mentioned the West Bank and security forces. Was there a lot of just military and support being given to the settlers, and that's why maybe they were caught off guard with the Gaza border?
Yeah, the government had transferred some of a chunk of the security forces from the Gaza area to the West Bank because, as we've seen in recent weeks before this started, things were really heating up with the settlers, right? They were getting more and more aggressive.
There was more violence in Huwara, right?
Right. There was another attack on Huwara. There were just, all sorts of attack in the Hebron Hills. There was the incident at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. So there was, and because we just got finished with the last of the Jewish New Year holiday, Sukkot, that was another reason that they were anticipating more settler activity. So they brought more soldiers from Gaza. And, the other part is, Gaza had seemed like nothing was going on. There has not been, there's been minimal rocket fire from Gaza. There have been minimal infiltration attempts from Gaza. So they thought that, we have pacified Gaza. Well, they were wrong. They had not pacified Gaza. And I think, again, there is a sort of an arrogance and frankly, a racism about the attitude that Israel has and that certainly the Israeli government has towards Palestinians in general, which is that they can be cowed, that they will accept, this confinement. And no matter how many times Palestinians show them, no, they will not. They still seem to think when things get quiet that they have successfully intimidated them. And, it's never been true. I don't see that as part of the Palestinian national character as something that can happen. So I would be, if I'm an Israeli, I would be raising some very serious questions about their judgment and how they made that call, deciding that we don't have to really worry so much about Gaza.
What was the relationship between Hamas and the Israeli government before this? Because I've seen criticism from Israel, from places like the Times of Israel, saying that Netanyahu almost like propped up Hamas at the expense of Abbas and other Palestinian groups and figures.
So there's a couple of things there. So one thing is the fundamental Israeli strategy for the past almost two decades. Since the split in the Palestinian leadership between when Hamas won the legislative elections in 2006 and subsequently withstood a coup that was put together by Fatah, the United States and Israel, where they tried to oust Hamas from Gaza, that failed. And since then, you've had this split with Gaza in the hands of Hamas and the West Bank administered to the extent that Israel lets them by the Palestinian Authority in Fatah. So Israel very much wants that situation to continue. Palestinians are divided. There's no one who can speak. When people say, oh, you need to negotiate with the Palestinians, they say, well, who are we supposed to negotiate with? We don't know. We don't. The Palestinians have a split leadership. They're not unified. Abbas can't speak for the whole nation anymore. So who are we supposed to negotiate with? It's a nonsensical argument, but it's the one they use. And of course, because the Europeans and Americans want to buy that whatever argument Israel comes up with, they can keep using it. So there's that part of it. The other part is that Hamas did, when they made the decision to become a political party, not just a militant one, they started becoming more of responsible or just an authority in and of themselves. They had to all of a sudden, when you're a militant group, you worry about the fight. Everything is about the fight. How do you lead the fight? How do you lead the resistance or whatever? When you are even under the siege that they're under, they still have to run day-to-day operations of life in Gaza. You have to worry about that. These are things you have to look out for. People want to make sure they need to get their electricity. They need to get their water. They need to get their food. They need to get all of that from Israel. That's the reality that Hamas has had to deal with. So there's been kind of a modus vivendi between them and the Israeli government. It has not obviously not always been comfortable. There's been flare-ups of violence and it's not like the two are best buddies. But Israel does not want to see Hamas fall because – they're pretty certain that one of two things will result from that. Either the Palestinians will reunify, which they don't want, or there will be a group that will take power in Gaza that is more determined to violently resist Israel than Hamas is.
Yeah, real quick, I was going to just to clarify for my listeners, Abbas, mm-hmm. we're referring to Mahmoud Abbas of the
yes.
PLO.
Mahmoud Abbas, yes.
Just to clarify that, because I didn't earlier. With regards to Hamas, can you talk about how they got to power? And also, I feel as if people don't really understand where Hamas came from. I mean, there's always talk about them being elected, but I don't think there's been many elections since, you know, a decade ago. Could you speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, there have been no national elections since the one in 2006 that brought Hamas into power. There have been municipal elections in both the West Bank and I think once or twice in Gaza. But Hamas started during the First Intifada. They were actually an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood that Israel ironically encouraged through the 80s to develop. Believing that a religious counterweight to the secular PLO would split Palestinian loyalty and give them an alternative that was, they believe, less apt to use violent resistance than the PLO was. Turned out that wasn't the case. That was a bit of a misjudgment, to say the least. And when Hamas finally did develop fully in the late 80s and into the early 90s, they saw themselves as a militant alternative to the PLO and acted accordingly. In 2006, they made the decision to turn to politics in a more organized way and decided to run against Fatah in national legislative elections. And Abbas actually recognized that Fatah was split and was in serious disarray because he's an incompetent administrator, but that's a different issue. And actually came to the Bush administration at the time, the George W. Bush administration, and said, you know, we would like to postpone these elections because we're not ready for them. And Bush, who at that time was, you know, managing the invasion of Iraq under the banner of bringing democracy to the Middle East, said, no, you have to the elections. We have to have the elections. And because of the Fatah's corruption, people's disillusionment with them, and the fact that they were running multiple candidates in the different districts, Hamas, which was running a single ticket, ended up winning a legislative majority. And they were initially in control of the Palestinian Legislative Council, working with Abbas, who was the president. The United States led a global boycott against the Palestinian Authority because Hamas was part of it, because they didn't like the result of a free and fair election. Everybody agreed, incidentally, that this was a free and fair election, or at least a fair one. There was some impediments to voting that were there, mostly because of Israel and the occupation. But everyone agreed that this was a legitimate election. But the United States didn't like it. And as I said before, they worked with Fatah and Israel to try and oust Hamas, whose main headquarters was in Gaza. And when they failed at that, the Fatah party ended up taking over in the West Bank, and Gaza was left in the hands of Hamas. And there's been that split ever since. So that has been, and that's remained the case right up until this day.
Not to get all Marxist here, but can you talk about the relationship of material conditions to just Israel-Palestine, the fighting and whatnot?
So, you know, obviously, you know, Gaza, I mean, one of the illustrations I've used over the years has been the idea of different kinds of occupation that Israel holds the Palestinians under. So you have Palestinian citizens of Israel who aren't quite imbued with the same rights as Jewish citizens of Israel, but they are citizens and have quite a bit more freedom than other Palestinians under Israeli rule. You have Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem. You have Palestinians under occupation in the West Bank, and you have Palestinians basically under siege, a long-term siege in Gaza. So Gaza has been blockaded by Israel essentially more or less since 2007, when Hamas took it over. That blockade has grown stronger and stronger over the years. And there are a few entryways for goods and international aid that can come into Gaza, but it is extremely impoverished. There's almost no healthy drinking water. Almost 100% of the drinking water of the water in Gaza is not fit for either human consumption or even use. It's not fit for showers or washing your hands or anything like that. Food, something like half the population of Gaza relies on food aid. Unemployment is over 30%, and for youth, it's over 50%. The material conditions in Gaza are terrible. In the West Bank, they're a little better. I mean, people can and do, work and have jobs and have businesses. And so there's something of an economy, but it's subject to frequent interruptions because Israel controls all the roads. And so there's a lot of disruption there. It was a big deal when Palestinians got 3G wireless service. So now we're on 5G in the rest of the world. So we can see this was not long ago that Palestinians just got 3G. So again, slowing things down in terms of the modern world. The economics of people in the West Bank are also poor, not as poor as in Gaza.
Real quick, it's very important for me to note this, because one thing I will always hear is, Gaza isn't under occupation. The Israelis left, quote unquote, in 2005. But I mean, really, if we're talking about it, I think, honestly, you could basically call what's happening in Gaza, or what was happening before this Hamas attack, an indirect occupation.
Yeah, in terms of the, occupation has a legal definition, and the legal definition depends on who controls it. Now, Israel controls all of Gaza's borders except for the southern border, which Egypt technically controls, but it works in cooperation with Israel in terms of the southern border. Israel kind of claims that it's all Egypt, but it's not true. There's very clear cooperation between the two countries. So control of all the borders. Israel also controls the shoreline. Gaza has a seashore. It's on the Mediterranean Sea. They only allow fishing up to, I believe it's 20 miles off the coast. So that's very, very limited. And even that, fishermen are frequently subject to being shot at by Israeli patrols. They will narrow the permitted space down to 5 miles very frequently. So and Israel controls the airspace completely. So it controls not only, and so that's not only in terms of planes or helicopters coming in, which there isn't much of since Israel destroyed the one airport Gaza had, but also the electronic airwaves. Israel also controls that. Israel supplies most of Gaza's electricity. So Gaza is dependent on Israel for electricity. It's also dependent on Israel for water.
Now. Yeah.
Now, well, in right. You were asking about has been. So Israel controls the electricity. They control the border crossings, which is how food gets in, and they control most of the water, because again, Gaza has no potable water, so they have to bring it in, and most of it comes from Israel. So that there's a massive dependency on Israel. So again, it's about control. Israel controls Gaza, but they're not inside Gaza. So, they said, fine, Hamas can deal with the picking up the garbage and keeping law and order, among the people of Gaza. They can deal with all that stuff, but effectively Israel controls it. And legally speaking, that means it's still under occupation.
Before we start closing out, if I don't mention this, I will have listeners that say I'm being biased or I'm not talking about it. But there's been a lot of noise made about the DSA protests recently that were pro-Palestinian, and the media has reported it as pro-Hamas. I have seen some voices that I think will say things that I feel are out of line, even things like, if these Israelis want to really support Palestinians, they should just leave, which I don't think it's as easy as
that. It's not realistic. Yeah.
I mean, especially if you don't have second citizenship, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. Do you want to have any comment about the left reaction to this?
I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, this is always a difficult issue on the left. It has been, you know, I have a number of colleagues in the DSA. This issue has been vexing for the DSA in general. There's a lot of split and there's a lot of rancor within the group over this whole issue. And then this incident, I think, from what I understand, the basic organizing of the rally was to support Palestinians and to call for an end to occupation and et cetera. I also understand that some of the messages that came out of there supported Hamas's attack. Obviously, and I think I've made this pretty clear throughout this conversation, I have a big problem with that. And I believe that we have to, again, you know, we have to approach these things ethically, and ethics demand that we protect civilians on all sides, and we do not tolerate attacks on civilians. And the idea is, somebody mentioned to me, well, are any Israelis really civilians because they're living on stolen land? I said, well, so am I. You know, I'm living on stolen land. Absolutely. Most, pretty much any white person in the West, whether you're in Canada, whether you're in the United States, whether you're in Australia, we're all living on stolen land. I don't think it's okay to shoot me for that. And, you know, sorry, but I don't find that acceptable. At the same time, as I very much support, the concept of decolonization and redressing everything that has happened through centuries of colonialism to indigenous people. Yes, that doesn't mean you can shoot me. And I don't know many indigenous people who believe they can shoot me because I live in the United States. So that's not, to me, that's not an answer. I think we have to condemn what Hamas did. I think we can also understand it, and we can also and we most importantly can send out a message that says the way out of this is equality and justice for all Israelis and Palestinians. And as I understand it, that was the bottom line message that the DSA was trying to put out there. And to that extent, I think they are completely reasonable. And unfortunately, what we have seen in the United States since this happened is that anybody who puts that message out is accused of being pro-Hamas, which is insane. You know, what we're trying to do is to resolve this, is to stop people from getting killed, including Israelis. And the only way to do it is for Palestinians to have their rights. And until we can all agree on that, I think the people who, you know, people who say that view is pro Hamas, I mean, if that is what Hamas is saying, then yeah, I'm going to agree with them too. Unfortunately, too often I do not see them as saying that, but I certainly do hear Palestinians saying that all the time, and they're right, which is why, you know, I support the Palestinian cause.
I was going to say too, getting back to that line about, you know, Hamas and Palestinians are not interchangeable terms. You know, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, it's impossible to say, it's ridiculous to say, I should say, that all Palestinians are Hamas supporters. You know, Hamas is an Islamic political and military organization. There's also secular Palestinians and, you know, Palestinians that are Muslim that aren't supporters of Hamas. And I think it's interesting. I think all those movements of the left amongst Palestinians in Palestine have sort of been destroyed over the years by various actors. And Hamas filled a vacuum. And I think also they provided things like mutual aid at various points that garnered support for them. Could you speak to those issues?
So Hamas is a religious movement. They are an Islamic movement. They also have their, you know, I've known people who are in it, who are in or connected to Hamas, who are secular. You know, I don't think that is all that unusual. And the reason is that, you know, for now, at least, there are two major parties among in the Palestinian body politic, and it's Fatah and Hamas. So, you know, for most people who are going to be directly involved, they have to be with one or the other. And Fatah is so corrupt and so has been so horrible in terms of leading the Palestinian cause. I think a lot of people are disillusioned. Hamas does not have that much support among the Palestinian public, as far as I can see. You know, that's what polling is done, and there is some shows that, you know, Hamas's ideology is not particularly popular among Palestinians, and Hamas has been very authoritarian in its rule in Gaza. They've been very harsh. They have been harsh to political opponents. They have been harsh to certainly to people protesting. They have violated human rights, as has Fatah, many times over the years. So I think a lot of people do not like, you know, equating Palestinians with Hamas or equating Palestinians with Fatah is as absurd as equating Americans entirely with Republicans or Democrats. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, very few of us actually are big, are big fans of either political party, even though many of us join them for, you know, a variety of reasons. I'm a registered Democrat, even though I do not particularly love the Democrats, but they're certainly a lot better than the Republicans. And, you know, so you have that sort of thing. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, Palestinians have been suffering remarkably for decade after decade, and it is a day-to-day hardship and a day-to-day hopelessness. So a lot of times, yeah, when they see somebody fighting back, they support that fight in the hope that it will free them at some point down the road.
Could you talk about the average age in Gaza?
So the average age is 18. There are a lot of children in Gaza. It is an extremely unhealthy place to be, as you can imagine from the things that I've told you about the conditions there. You know, when there's no potable water, people are crammed in there in you know, poverty conditions. Food is not consistently delivered, and you take what you can get. You can't necessarily always have a balanced diet. Sometimes medicine is inaccessible. Sometimes medical care is often inaccessible because very often Gaza does not have the facilities to treat serious medical problems. And so, you know, you have to hope that Israel will let you out to go to a hospital either in the West Bank or in Israel or maybe in Egypt or you know, somewhere the way you can get adequate treatment. All of that combines to create a situation where the life expectancy in Gaza is not very long. And so you have a very young age, average age of the people in Gaza.
And I mean, I bring this up because I want people to remember children are going to die in these bombings.
Yeah, they already are. So we've already, I think the last report I saw was something like 140 children dead in Gaza, and that was a while ago. So I'm sure that's gone up. That is a reality. And again, it comes back to the theme that I think I've been repeating over and over. This does not end until we value all of these lives, until we value Israeli lives, until we value Palestinian lives, and until we actually not just avoid killing them, but actually value their lives to make their lives full, meaningful, and hopeful, as any of us have a right to expect.
Just a few more things here, real briefly. So I was going to say, I see a lot of social media accounts arguing now and a lot of the usual suspects saying, oh, but the pro-Palestinian side ignores this. And one thing I keep seeing is, well, Netanyahu gave advanced warning and he said to leave. And, you know, they'll also say he told Gazans to leave these areas that were near Hamas buildings and headquarters. And I've said to people, you know, Gaza is so densely populated that moving around and getting to somewhere that's outside of that bombing area is very difficult. Not only that, you just have the Rafah crossing being bombed. So I don't know how, you know, Gazans are going to get into Egypt. And also, I'm not sure Egypt is looking to take in all these refugees.
Yeah.
Could you comment on all of that?
So I think, this has been a ridiculous canard. And again, it shows the ignorance of people about the situation in Gaza. Gaza has been for many, many years, many decades, in fact, one of the most densely populated places on the planet. At times, it has been the number one most densely populated place on the planet. It is not feasible for people to simply go away from this or that place. For one thing, during this bombing, Israel doesn't even, you know, Netanyahu said, you know, you people from Gaza, you better leave. To where? They can't, number one, they can't get out. Number two, they can run to different spots in Gaza. Israel has actually bombed shelters for people who have fled bombing. So that, and that has already happened. This is just the beginning of the operation, and that's happened before in Gaza. It is, the other part is, of course, now in the past, Israel has given warnings to people in certain buildings. What they do is they knock at the door is what they call it. They'll drop a low level bomb on the roof so that people know a big one's coming. And sometimes people in Gaza understand this and get out. And sometimes they don't know what's going on and they don't get out. But, you know, so there is that. But now they're not doing that. They apparently say that they're issuing warnings electronically, but that doesn't help since there's no electricity in Gaza. Nobody can charge their computer and their cell phone. So that is a useless thing now. I mean, it is impossible. They can't leave. And yeah, I agree. I don't know. It's interesting to me that Egypt has not said anything about the bombing of Rafah, at least not yet to my knowledge. And I do wonder if they're not a little bit relieved that they don't have to deal with a massive flow of tens of thousands of people from Gaza who are, who would naturally try to get out through the Rafah crossing and into Egypt. I don't know that Egypt could handle that. And that is another question, although that at the moment, at least, is unclear. And Egypt has certainly not made any comment about whether or not people from Gaza take some refuge, at least for a few days, on their side of the border. So, but yes, when people say, "Oh, Netanyahu's warned them to go," yeah, there's nowhere to go. There is literally nowhere for people in Gaza to go. You say, "Well, they're going to bomb over here, so I'll run over here," but they're going to bomb over here too. So that doesn't help. You're going from one target to another. It's like you see in a cartoon where, you go bang, 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 this back, this and that. And I believe that's exactly how Netanyahu and many Israeli leaders look at it. And again, it's that same dehumanization. And they're saying this for public consumption. They're saying this so that the people who asked you that question will have that question in their mind to ask you.
What do you say to the people that will say, well, Hamas uses human shields, and they'll run in to these apartment buildings or these shelters or these mosques? So the Israelis have no choice but to bomb these buildings.
So a couple things. First of all, that's not what happens. Hamas has used sites they should not use. They have used UN facilities to store weapons. This has happened a couple times over the years. They have used public, but that's part of asymmetric warfare. Also, you got to remember, Hamas is not the Israeli army or any other army. They don't have that kind of facility. There are no Hamas army bases that they can fire from so that Israel knows exactly where they are. Number one, that would not be very effective. But number two, they just don't have that kind of capacity. That they're not a regular army. So part of that. The other thing is that frequently, I've seen this argument many times when a Hamas member is killed with his entire family. So in other words, he went home. What happened is he went home. Same as Israeli soldiers go home, Israeli generals go home. None of us would say that it is okay to drop a bomb on the roof of an Israeli general as he sits down or she sits down to a dinner with their extended family. And there's 15 people around the table. None of us would consider that okay, I think, none of us would consider that part of the regular mode of combat. So that is essentially what is happening to members of Hamas. They go back home to their families and get bombed because Israel knows where they live. Many of them don't go home for exactly that reason. The concept of human shields, Israel uses human shields as well. Israel also has a number of military facilities in the middle, like, for example, in the middle of Tel Aviv with apartment buildings right next to it. So if Hamas would fire rockets at that military base and hit the apartment buildings, do we think that call that Israel using human shields? Because that's essentially the same thing that they're saying. I mean, we have this again in America. People live near military bases. Military base is a legitimate target. So is the United States using human shields? Is NATO using human shields? I mean, it is all. They're all attempts to come up with reasons that it is okay to kill Palestinian civilians or to kill Palestinians, period. And that is exactly the argument we should not be tolerating. it's not okay to kill Palestinians. It's not okay to kill Israelis. We have to stop the killing. That is exactly what needs to stop. And it cannot stop until there is justice for people on both sides of this question.
Do you worry about what's currently happening in the U.S. in response to this? What I mean by that is, I'll be honest, I've reached out to Jewish friends of mine to see if they're okay. And I know a lot of people in the community that are hurting right now. I also know Palestinians that are being harassed a lot. Someone who I respect very much, a Palestinian activist and a very notable female Hollywood filmmaker, Lexi Alexander, I've seen her harassed a lot in the past few days. People tagging the FBI and the DHS saying, oh, you should deport this Palestinian woman, this filmmaker, because she's Palestinian. And I really am worried about the dehumanization of Palestinians living in America, especially when you have these nutters like right-wingers like Laura Loomer running around saying Hamas has infiltrated the U.S. with their cells and there's going to be a terror attack any day now. I'm really worried for both the – I mean, I'm worried about rising anti-Semitism in the U.S. I'm in Florida right now. I've read about synagogue attacks, but I'm also extremely worried about dehumanization of Palestinians.
Yeah, but this is, you know, unfortunately, this has been going on for many, many years. This isn't, you know, and of course, it's going to be much worse now because of all of this. But the entire attitude, this is what I've been talking about for much of this past hour, is, you know, the idea we just saw the president of the United States issue a statement where only Israelis matter. Only Israeli lives make a difference. Palestinian lives do not matter. So what do we expect when the president and an ostensibly liberal president at that? This isn't Donald Trump up there. You know, this isn't even George W. Bush. This is a Democrat. This is somebody who's supposed to be the nice guy. He's supposed to be the respectable one. And he puts out a statement where he clearly is telling people Palestinian lives are meaningless, are worthless. That is just a horrible thing.
I'm seeing just an hour ago, CNN posted an article headlined, Biden did not urge restraint in Gaza in call with Netanyahu.
Yeah, I mean, well, that is true. As a matter of fact, apparently the State Department was ordered to delete two tweets on two separate occasions in the past couple of days where they talked about a ceasefire. They talk about trying to get to a ceasefire, just hinted at, just said, maybe we should try to get to a ceasefire. And that came from the White House. No, get that out of there. You cannot have this. We want to see blood. Basically, we want to see blood flowing in the streets of Gaza. That is what is desired right now. So, you know, yeah, unfortunately, this is a real problem. The idea that Palestinians are not human beings is at the root of so much of what's going on now. You know, in the end, how do people in their minds, in their hearts, justify the idea that Israelis have rights, Palestinians don't, and yet we're on the side of the Israelis? The only way you can ultimately do that is that Palestinians are less than human, or certainly less human than Israelis. And it's the only way you can justify that. We all, you know, when you put it that way, anybody would say, oh, no, that's not true. But in practice, when you don't have to think about it in those words, that is what's coming through. And I share your concern. I think Palestinians in this country are in big trouble. I know that many of them are, you know, even if they're not being harassed, they see the way their country responds to the lives of their families in Gaza and in the West Bank. And it hurts them. Palestinian Americans are looking at their country, they're looking at their president, and he doesn't care about them and their families. It is a terrible, terrible thing to see. And it is reminiscent of the worst racism in the history of the United States. And I share your fear. I am afraid. I'm afraid for myself as a Jew, in terms of how the backlash to this and people on the other side, they, you know, because you dehumanize one side, the other side dehumanizes you. That's what happens. And I've seen plenty of that. And I've told people, if you're going to tell me that the people in Israel who were killed by Hamas over the weekend deserve what they got, F off. I'm not interested in hearing from you. I feel that very strongly. And I would say that whether I was Jewish or not. So I'm worried about myself as a Jew. I'm worried about my family as Jews, and I'm worried about all my Palestinian brothers and sisters. And I worry for the whole attitude of this country as I see how much bloodlust Americans are expressing, people who aren't even over there. So you can multiply that even more for what Israelis are feeling and what Palestinians are feeling. And you know, the wonderful thing is you can also look and see so many of them, and I see this on both sides, who are opening their hearts and saying, we have to stop this. So, and it would be nice if our government would for once support those people instead of supporting the ones who want more guns and more warships and more aircraft carriers and you know, all of this.
I want to give my closing comments here. First, I want to say, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, the media has been all over that DSA protest. What they haven't really been talking about, and I have seen it though from, I believe it was the Jewish Forward, pointing out that there are, you know, left-wing Jewish activists that are not pro-Hamas that still support Palestinians. And I wish the media would amplify those voices and admit that those voices are there too. Real quickly, if I could, I wanted to read a tweet that George Takei, Mr. Sulu from
Star Trek. Yes, I retweeted him.
I saw that. So for people that don't know, George Takei was not only the star of Star Trek as Mr. Sulu, one of the main stars of it, but he also was in a Japanese internment camp growing up during World War II. And he wrote recently, and this is based a lot in part on his experience of being in a Japanese-American internment camp, "The Israeli government has cut off food, water, and fuel to 2 million people inside Gaza. Collective punishment is not only contrary to international law, it is inhumane and illogical. How will this de-escalate the violence rather than radicalize many more? It is madness." I just want you to be able to comment on his comments and also just reiterate the importance of being against collective punishment.
Yeah, I was very happy to see George Takei's comments, not just because I am an enormous Star Trek fan. That was nice, that part of it. But he is somebody who I've always found to be, you know, he's obviously a very strong advocate for the rights of Japanese Americans and for LGBTQIA folks, because that is, you know, his community as well. But in general, I've seen his politics as being very much in line with the Democratic Party. You know, it's sort of I don't want to say typical, but he certainly has strong and good political beliefs, but they're very much in line with, you know, liberal Americans who are well-to-do like he is, which is fine. And I rarely had cause to really to strongly disagree with him, even if we're not always entirely on the same page. He's never really weighed in on this issue, to my knowledge. I followed him for years on Twitter. I never saw it before. If he did, I missed it. I thought this was, you know, this was a good statement, and it was an important statement. It was one where, in no way is he justifying violence against anyone. He's not taking sides. He's saying, you know, we have to act like human beings, which seems to be a lot to ask for a lot of people, but I don't think it should be. I was very, very happy to see, what he had to say here.
And just again, reiterating, your thoughts on the importance of speaking out against collective punishment.
So I think, I mean, this should be obvious, right? I mean, if my brother, I have one brother, if my brother committed a crime, okay, and the police said, you know, we can't find him, so we're going to put you in jail. I mean, who considers that just? Who thinks that's okay? Or if let's say my wife committed a crime, so, you know, they're you know, myself and my son all have to go to jail. That doesn't make any sense. That is the basic principle behind the forbidding of collective punishment. You do not make people pay for crimes they did not commit. It doesn't matter. And again, let's also keep in mind, it doesn't matter what their political beliefs are. Okay. I cannot let, you know, if I have a neighbor down the road who is a white nationalist, I don't have to like that person. I don't have to talk to them. I can argue with them. And all of this, but they have rights, and then they can't go to jail because of and I can't assault them because of their political beliefs, assuming that they don't, you know, in some violent way act on them against me. So this is all the same. This is all the same thing. And when, you know, even if we want to get past, even if you don't care about the ethical dimensions here, the pragmatic dimensions are when you do this, you know, when you punish 2 million people over what is absolutely a war crime. There's no question about it. It was a horrible, obscene act that Hamas did last weekend. But when you punish 2 million people, what you're doing is creating many, many, out of those 2 million, many thousands more who will take up that same, who will do that same kind of act later, because you've dehumanized them. This is, you know, you dehumanize, you treat people like criminals. 2 million people, certainly at least several thousand of them are going to actually act like one.
Yeah, I don't want to keep, I've already kept you overly long, but it brings to mind something here. You know, I keep seeing people saying this is the end of the Palestinian cause. This is what Hamas has done has destroyed the credibility of the Palestinian cause. The Palestinians are done. This is going to be a complete ethnic cleansing in Gaza. Do you think, I'm not so sure about that. I don't think the Palestinians are down for the count. And I think it's arrogant for Westerners to say Palestinians are done for.
Yeah, I saw one commentary that I thought was a little closer to the mark, where somebody said, you know, this is the, you know, Hamas will no longer be able to claim sort of a place in the international forum as international leaders. And I think that may be true. I think the nature of this attack may be true, but I don't think this is in any way the end of the Palestinian cause, unless the United States and Europe are willing to stand by and actually let Israel basically wipe out the Palestinian people in the occupied territories. I don't think we're at that point. Although, given some of the rhetoric I've seen, not just from Israelis, but from you know, world leaders, the way they've talked about this and the complete indifference they've shown to life, you know, one has to worry about that. But I think short of that, no, the Palestinian cause will continue. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, it may advance because of this, because I think it will impact Saudi Arabia and their efforts to normalize with Israel. I think it will motivate more, you know, when the smoke clears, so to speak, I think there will be a greater motivation to try and actually resolve this conflict. I think people have realized now that the Palestinian issue, as we've been saying, as, you know, people for years, the last decade or so, the Palestinian cause has faded farther and farther from the center of the international arena. And we've been telling people it's going to come back in a way you're not going to like.
Not just that. I mean, this has exposed that the occupation is unsustainable.
Yes. I mean, it has exposed that, but it has also proven that the Palestinian issue is not going to go away. It's not just fading into the background. It's not something you can avoid. It has to be dealt with. So, you know, I don't want to say that it's going to turn out that Hamas ends up, this act ends up being good for the Palestinians. But I do think that this can serve as a stepping stone towards motivating the rest of the world to actually finally dealing with this. And that means pressuring Israel to change its policies. I think there is a possibility that will take a long time. It's not going to happen in a month. It's not going to happen this year. But, you know, I think that we may see that something has changed here that can finally maybe start to lead to something productive instead of the just steady decline in the situation that we've seen really over the past three decades.
Well, I want to thank you again, Mitchell Plitnick, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
You can always find me at my website, rethinkingforeignpolicy.org, all one word. You can follow me on Twitter. I will not call it that other thing. At MJ Plitnick. I'm also on Blue Sky. You can find me by searching my name there. I'm on Mastodon, Facebook. You can find me all over the place doing those things. And if you do follow me somewhere other than Twitter, I'd appreciate it, just because I'd love to get off there. And I would lose too many followers right now if I did. So let's all move away from Mr. Musk.
That does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found some value in my conversation with Mitchell Plitnick. As always, if you can, please support my show on patreon.com/parallaxviews. This is all independently produced. I really, really could use your support. Patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it. Just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.